up this morning with the sundown shining in him.
Where's the money, Lebowski? Where's the f***ing money, head?
It's down there somewhere. Let me take another look.
I found my mind in a brown paper bag, but then...
106 miles to Chicago. We got a full tank of gas, half a pack of cigarettes. It's dark, and we're wearing sunglasses.
Hit it.
I tripped on a cloud and fell 8 miles high. I tore my mind on a jagged sky.
Okay, you know, you guys aren't privy to all the new so, you know, that's what you pay me for.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in.
Illinois Nazis. I hate Illinois Nazis.
Yeah, let's cut to the chase, okay? What are you guys selling?
I lost you $60,000. There is no one who wants to make that money back for you more than I do.
There's just one thing, dude.
What's that?
You have to use so many cuss words.
What the f*** are you talking about?
Don't worry, nobody's listening anyway.
I woke up this morning with the sundown.
We're on Oak Bay Stacks and Jacks. I'm Ricky on the board. S&P futures up 12. NASDAQ futures up 128 as we're trying to negotiate an up day for the end of the week. Last week we were up a little bit. Early yesterday we were up a little bit. Trying to make a strong end here. We'll see if we do that or not. We finished. We were up pretty much heavy. Pretty heavy all day yesterday. Then kind of leaked out on the close, but still finished up. We have Professor Kevin.
Morning.
How are you?
Well, I'm doing all right.
Well, that's a good thing. So are you pissed off like Amazon at the needless markup situation?
You see, no, why would I care?
Well, who knows? Maybe you got Amazon stock, a guy like you. Somehow or another, Amazon got involved in... These guys, Sachs took over Neiman Marcus, right?
Yeah.
And it says here, Amazon filed an objection to the bankruptcy financing plan on the grounds it could harm creditors and push the tech company further down the repayment pecking order. I didn't realize that they were involved in this thing. I didn't either,
but as someone who has never shopped there and was never likely to shop there, I don't know why I would care a whole lot. And if, you know, Amazon, I do shop at Amazon, but, you know, why do I don't worry endlessly about their financial machinations either.
Well, it's just kind of weird that somehow they would get in. Evidently plugged $475 million into the acquisition, Kevin, and now it's worthless. I didn't know they were involved in that at all. It's kind of a weird deal.
Didn't either. Don't know why they would have either. I don't think that's necessarily a smart move, because it's not the kind of business, unless they are looking for a clientele and maybe product lines that they wouldn't otherwise have. But I don't know. You know, maybe trying to have a separate brand that would be for high-end buyers. Who might look down their nose at Amazon. I don't know. You know, that's just some wild ass guesses on what the strategy might be, but I have no idea what they were really trying to accomplish. I'm just thinking I would never invest in a department store at this point in time.
Yeah, it's pretty tough. Or it might just have too much money. that's a thought too, but hopefully that's not the reason. But they threaten more drastic remedies. Reason why it makes me curious, Kevin, is every time I've tried to follow one of these bankruptcies, you know, cities and wherever else, that's a whole different world, that whole bankruptcy thing, who gets to be involved in the front row and the back row, and if you have the debt somehow or other, even if you bought it like the week before at 10 cents on the buck, you get kind of a, sometimes you get a seat at the table and you end up with all the new stock and you get your money back on the bonds and you can make out like a bandit in these things, and sometimes you can't. And you know, I guess I just knew just a little bit enough about it to find it amazingly interesting and how uneven it always seemed to be. Or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was just me. I don't know. But it does seem like who gets, you know, the debt versus equity versus city versus unions versus other all seems to be really kind of a free-for-all, doesn't it?
There's a whole art to it, and the art is trying to be the one who isn't left holding the bag, or at least is not a smaller bag than everybody else.
Yeah, I mean, it's a interesting world. Well, what do you make of all this, the people on the you sent me the thing yesterday around the gambling issues? And boy, you're right about when you start talking about people not knowing what the definition of point shaving and everything is. How do you think I feel when I hear people using definitions on economics all day long that are wrong? I
mean, no kidding. Tom's referring to this, that, you know, they keep calling these point shaving scandals. Well, the fact of the matter is, if you're an underdog, point shaving, if you're a favorite, is a matter of saying, I'm going to win, but I'm going to win by less. And so you're going to influence a lot of bets that way. That's point shaving. Point shaving doesn't apply to an underdog. It can't apply to an underdog because you might be saying, I'm going to lose, and maybe if I shave some points, I'm going to lose by more. But by simply going to the act of trying to lose by more, you're saying, I'm not trying to win. I'm throwing the game. And that's completely different. And that, you know, in the annals of American sports, throwing games is very, very... that's kind of the lowest breach of trust in any competition.
How do you, you know, we talk a lot, I mean, we joust a lot about, you know, business moral lines in the sand, political moral lines, moral lines. Just the idea that people, I'm probably not going to go this far on the line, but just the fact that people are aware of what the spreads are and who's most likely to be betting on one side or the other, I almost wonder by definition if that isn't crooked. I mean, I don't know if I want to go that far, but you tell me. I mean, I'm referring to the one you sent me 2 weeks ago, the Packer game, where they were, 13.5-point dogs in a game where they didn't play anybody because they wanted to get arrested for the Bears, and they were down, 16 to nothing, and they kicked the field goal, the useless field goal, to make it 13 instead of 13.5.
Field goal changed the outcome against the spread, yeah.
I mean, I think all of that is just the fact that you're aware of it. I don't know if I was the coach of, I'll use an example, Paul Bear Bryant, has long been dead, so I can talk about him. He kicked the field goal, useless field goal late in the game when his team was up by a certain amount. They said, what'd you kick the field goal for? And he said, because the spread was 16 and we were only up 15 or something, and I know the Alabama people bet on Alabama. I mean, just, I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do with that one, Kevin. I really don't.
To manipulating the score versus the threat, or the threat versus the spread. From my standpoint, I understand that some coaches are just, you know, real pissy about things, and if it's I'm not going to give you the shutout, I'm going to give you the take them the 3 points, and whatever it is, I'm going the pit coach against Notre Dame this year, scoring useless touchdown, calling timeout to score a useless touchdown when his team's getting blown out and he wants to score a touchdown on the last play of the game, those kinds of things. I kind of admit that I would be a bit of an asshole when it comes to that kind of stuff. Not because of the point spread, but just because I'm not very nice when I'm competing.
Well, I mean, you can't really tell your second string. I mean, at that point in the game, it's probably your second string against the other guy's second string. How do you tell them not to try and score?
Or your second string against their starters are still in.
Yeah, well, how do you tell them not to try and score? I mean, I don't get that.
I think especially if you're winning by a lot, you empty your bench. You want your bench guys to have a chance to shine.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't see how you. What do you do? Tell a guy not to miss his block on purpose?
Right. That would be more insulting than anything you could do.
Yeah. But just the idea that every coach seems to know now the spread. I just wonder if, by definition, you aren't walking into waters you don't want to be in.
I think they've always known the spreads.
All right. Well.
Yeah, for better or for worse.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Like I said, Bear Bryant's been dead for 30 years. So, yeah, I'm just saying, the act does gambling get into the game, and how much does it? I mean, is that something that – is that point shaving? Is that manipulating the score? It is, I guess.
Well, you're asking how much it influences decisions. That was always the Pete Rose issue. He said, well, I never bet against my team. Yeah, but it influences your decisions. You know, when you're when you have money on the game, are you more likely to leave a pitcher in long, you know, where this isn't good for your team for the next game or for, you know, or for the season, for managing the pitcher's availability for the season. But if you have money on the game, are you more likely to leave a pitcher in the game longer, longer than you should, just because you need to get this next out? So, you know, when gambling gets into the game, there's not a lot of good that's going to come out of it.
Yeah, I would sort of agree with
and
that.
Really, you know, not only from a gambling standpoint, but from an entertainment standpoint, part of the appeal of sports is that everybody is competing as best they can. They're not making decisions based on anything other than I'm up at the plate and I'm going to drive this damn ball as hard as I can. I'm dropping back to pass. I need to complete this. Whatever it is, the premise of the sport and the appeal of the sport is that competition is on the up and up.
Well, so by definition, can gambling save a professional or save sports? I mean, I don't know. I think that's kind of a bad marriage.
I think it's a horrible marriage. Again, you know, they're making revenue decisions that aren't necessarily good strategy decisions. They're not good product strategy decisions.
Well, on another kind of sports note, I wasn't going to talk about this, but in a way, it's all I hear about, that evidently Springfield's warming up to the Bears a little bit.
And yeah, because they're trying to leverage their rumblings with Indiana.
Yeah, well, I mean, we talk about, you know, some of the things that are said in politics and business and sports, and I think you as a teacher and me, that somebody who likes economic definitions, I don't know why, we both collectively shake our heads at what we hear people say. And people seem to have, the media, I'm not talking about, you know, people in office, I'm saying the media seems to dump, how the hell can I put this, Kevin? They dumb things down to a level to where it's almost misleading, or maybe it is misleading. You know what I'm saying?
Misleading.
I don't think it's somebody doing it. It's not Soros doing it. It's not Trump doing it. They somehow feel that this is where every man is, and when they talk to him, not using the right numbers, the right words. It almost becomes disinformation, doesn't it? I mean, this whole thing about, you could listen to people talking about stadiums to it comes out you're behind, for God's sake, and you'll never once hear anybody put up the cost number, the rent number, the carry number, the interest rate number. Who's gonna? You'll never learn anything about the thing. Is that on purpose, or are they just people can't understand it, or what? I have no idea.
I think you get a lot of media creatures, certainly a lot of people of politics and other ruling class creatures that they just believe, they don't have any respect for normal people, let's put it that way. And what that means is, to me, is the way it translates is, yeah, they dumb it down, they leave the things out that you can't handle, you know, they do that kind of crap. When you're everybody else's betters, then you can control the story to steer them in the direction you want them to go.
Well, I mean, the stadium, to me, I mean, being the economic goofball that I am, it's real simple. There's going to be a cost. There's going to be a revenue stream. Who's going to pay for it? What's the interest rate? And what's the infrastructure kick in from the government? There's like five variables there. It's not that tough, is it? I mean, nobody cares, I don't think, if the state paid, you know, $5 billion for a stadium. I mean, people would care, but if they paid $5 billion for a stadium, which leaves you at a rate of, let's say it's the state, what do you think the state has to go out with for money now? Probably five, because it's tax deductible. So that's $250 million. If the Bears paid $350 in rent, would anybody care? I mean, what's the difference? As long as it's covered, right? I mean, but they're not going to do that. I mean, it's all about, okay, well, somebody's going to pay this $5 billion. What are they going to pay? Well, they're going to pay like $8 billion. Okay. I mean, that leaves one hell of a downfall. Whose shoe does that land on? And I think it's going to land on ours, right? I mean, And I, you know, that's the problem. If the thing went out like any other project, nobody would care. If the Bears want to put $2 billion into it, and the state does three, okay, they now own 40% of the stadium entity, right? Which is totally separate than the Bears football team. Now the Bears football team pays rent. Maybe you can get concerts and all the other kind of crap in there, so you'd have a revenue stream other than the Bears. But at some point, some knucklehead like a young me walks in there and says, okay, here's our interest costs, here's our security costs, here's our painting the parking lot every couple, here's our whole list of crap that's going to cost us to keep this place up. And oh, by the way, the Bears are paying here, the concerts are returning here, the home run or whatever, the demolition derby's paying here, and here's how it all ends up. And by the way, at the end of the year, our revenue is a dollar more than our expenses, and everybody would probably cheer, wouldn't they? What's the difference? But that's not what's happening, is it?
No, it's just a drain on the taxpayers. Or to put it another way, let's just say it is profitable. Who reaps the profits?
Well, I mean, I don't have a problem if there's 100,000 left in the stadium authority. The state takes 60, and the Bears, because they're 40%, they're over the stadium authority, they get 40. I don't have a problem with that, do you?
I don't. The problem is that it doesn't. It seldom winds up being a net positive.
Oh, yeah. And why isn't it? Because the rent's too small. I mean, why has Soldier Field been a bomb? Because the rent, the Bears are paying $6.5 million a year in rent. I think the people in Buffalo, in their new stadium, God, Kevin, we got a listener that wrote in and talked about what a great new stadium they're building. I think Buffalo is paying less than $6 million in the old place. I think they're only going to pay like $7 or $8 million in the new place. And things costing a fortune. Buffalo has got one coming up, and I think the guy in Kansas City is where the state's going to build a place to move them across the river. How does that accrete to anything in the other state? I mean, the bars that are going to be bars are full. You know, and by the way, I was talking to one of my buddies last night that works in the trading communities, a risk manager for some big firm. Smart guy, and he loves going to German food, right? And I was saying the other day that Audrey and I, we had dinner with a fellow in Burr Ridge on Saturday night, and it's probably the happening place in Burr Ridge. I mean, Burr Ridge got a lot of money, so when I say that, I've never seen that bar. Let's put it this way, Kevin. There were 10 times more people in there when it was supposedly closed during COVID than there were last Saturday. He calls me up and he goes, hey, I got us a table in the bar looking right at the TV. And I'm going, I don't even know there was a table in the bar with four people or three people. We walk in, Kevin, he didn't even have to call in. I mean, there was like 10 people or six of them were obnoxious Bear fans yelling at every play. Now, so this guy tells me he went to this...
That's redundant, you know.
Yeah. So he went to this really good German place that's somewhere around Harlem Avenue and Irving Park. He goes, the place is usually pretty crowded. He goes, we went Saturday night. He said, we were like the only people in there. They were shutting down early. So the idea that every place is packed, everybody's making money because of the Bears, is not true. Now, I would guess that the city of Chicago, probably were the beneficiaries of a lot of Wisconsin money that would have been spent up there, right? And maybe if the game was up there, maybe a lot of Bear fans would have gone up there and spent money on the weekend. So you're going to get a little bit of a geographical shift if the places are commutable. I mean, I don't know how many Bear fans would go to a game in, you know, I was going to say San Diego, but they're not a team anymore. I don't know how many Bear fans would travel to Seattle. Some, probably, huh?
The Bears do travel well. Seattle, not sure. When anybody plays in Las Vegas, they get a lot of people.
Yeah.
You know, that always happens. But, you know, my son, who is a big Bears fan, anytime the Bears are out west, he'll go to San Diego, he'll go to L.A., he'll go wherever to see a game.
Well, I mean, I just, if you're going to be rigorous about this, and I think both of us, I mean, you surely take your details to heart when you're teaching and everything else, and I try to as well. You know, but I mean, when everybody, you'll hear people say stuff like, oh man, look at all the Cardinal fans here in Chicago. Isn't this great? Look at how great the Cubs are. Okay, well, the next, you at least have to think immediately, like I would, what about the next weekend? The Cubs are in St. Louis. How many Cub fans are down there? Maybe more, maybe less. But isn't that the flip side of the coin?
Oh, yeah. And so, yes, and there are rivalries like that that do fill up. Cubs-Cardinals is one of them, you know, where the fans for both sides will travel a lot. But, yeah, there are others, you know. I think a lot of Bears fans go to Detroit to see a game.
Yeah, I know a lot of guys take the train.
Yeah, because that's pretty easy to do.
Plus, there's a really nice, I guess there's a really nice hotel right near the train and the stadium. It's almost like walkable all three or something. Maybe you got to take an Uber from the.
I'll have to check it out sometime.
Yeah, they're nice time.
I actually looked at it for Thanksgiving and thought about going over, but the ticket prices were so damn high. I said, yeah, I'll stay home, nap on the couch.
I would really like to go to a game up in Lambeau. But every single time, it seems like it's late in the year and it's a night game. I don't want to do it. If it's a noon game, I'd do it.
Yeah, the Irish are opening the season against Wisconsin in Lambeau.
Funny you should mention that. I was digging around.
Night game, by the way.
It's going to be a night game?
I think so.
Well, I was digging around yesterday for what do you call those things? VRBOs or Airbnbs. Seeing if we could grab a place. There's a real nice place in Sturgeon Bay. It's probably 40 miles away. It's not horrible. Just saying.
Yeah, well, you should look into it. It'd be a fun trip.
Yeah, the question is how far away. There's not really something right in Green Bay that I've found yet. But, I mean, if it's up on, it's 20 miles away, and on the water, we could go for a few days. We'd have a nice time, I think. We can always find a bar in Wisconsin, can't we?
Yeah, we'd go to Sturgeon Bay. I'd be fine.
Yeah. You think we ever have a problem finding a bar in Wisconsin?
No. No, there are so many bars, and we would hang out at the supper clubs, Tom.
Yes, we'd be at the out there dancing with all the 80-year-old ladies.
I can't polka anymore.
Oh God, no!
I don't know if I ever could, but I can now.
You know, we're not for those that this is crazy world. But when we were in Kevin and I were in South Bend, Indiana was dry on Sundays, so of course. We, of course, had to have a workaround, as he used to say. And there was a bar across, literally, you turned, I think, in Indiana, and you made a little bit of a bend in this road, and there was this bar called Kubiak's. It couldn't have been 40 feet. Remember, wasn't the parking lot in Indiana and the bar in Michigan or something bizarre like that coming?
Right, man.
So we would go there on Sunday night, and it was polka night. These older ladies, I'm guessing mostly from Polish descent or whatever. If you were available to dance, even if you were, like, they didn't care. They come and grabbed you by the earlobe, but basically said you're dancing, and we were out there polking and had a great time. Ooh, there were pitchers like a buck and a half or something, but you know there was no saying no to those ladies, was there?
No, there actually wasn't.
So on the way back from the reunion, I says to Audrey, let's drive by Kubiak's. I want you to see this place. We drove and she goes, you used to go to that? Kevin, I never saw it in the daytime. I don't think I ever saw it in the daytime. I can't believe how small and kind of dilapidated the place is. I'm like, yeah, that's it. She goes, you guys went there? Yes, we did.
Well, there, yeah. Well, there were other places in Michigan, but because nothing was open in Indiana, that was your only choice on a Sunday night. So, you know, first place over the state line got a lot of business. Kubiak's is still there.
Oh, yeah, that's what I'm saying. We went by it. And, they did pave the parking lot, though.
That same family still owns it, too.
Wow. Hey, out of all the news here, it's kind of fit to print. Instead of diving into some political discussions, which you never can seem to come out of, out of all the news that's out there, and there's a buffet of it, if you were me, which ones would you be concerned about more for which stocks or the market in general? Which industries? What about the dollar? What about interest rates? If you were me, what would you be watching the closest?
Well, I'd still be watching trade. I would be watching the Supreme Court decision on tariffs. What do you think of the trade deal with Taiwan? I just saw that we have one now, but I don't know what it.
They all seem the same. There's always some kind of promise, and then there's this big chunk of money coming this way, and I don't know, you're into that more than I am. Have you ever seen one of those? Actually, the one in Arizona is complete, isn't it? There's not too many of them that actually seem to work, do they? I mean, that one I think is up and running at the size at which it was promised, isn't it? The one in, is it Scottsdale or someplace? Glendale?
Yeah, actually, I think it's on the other side of the other side of town.
But is it, you know, that whoever they were promised $5 billion up and running in 3 years, it actually was $5 billion up and running in 3 years? I mean, the one in Racine is a clunk. The one in the same company promised
that,
in Ohio.
Not exactly, Tom. First of all, the Foxconn deal, the way Scott Walker negotiated the deal was that they got a lot of breaks, a lot of tax breaks, but only if, you know, it was specifically tied to the number of jobs that they created. And so, when Tony Evers was running for governor, one of the big parts of his campaign was, I'll renegotiate the Foxconn deal. It's a bad deal. And so he did. As soon as he got into office, he renegotiated the Foxconn deal, and he made it more of a fixed tax break rather than a variable tax break. And it was then that Foxconn went ahead and didn't meet any of their goals, and they still got all the tax breaks. So, you know, just some abject stupidity about how that worked.
But they also,
but nevertheless, that whole area has still boomed because they built out the infrastructure for Foxconn. But it turns out now there's all kinds of distribution stuff up there that wasn't there before because they still built out the infrastructure. So they did get a lot out of it.
Well, when the thing was originally signed? Hell, you and I were on the air. Wasn't it you that said that Foxconn had a very similar deal? Was it near Cleveland or Pittsburgh or someplace that was a total clunk? They never finished it. They never did anything. This was not their first go around.
Yeah, right? It wasn't the first time they didn't deliver, and that was why Walker was smart to say, this is contingent. We're not just going to give away the store, and so it was a smart move, and it got undone, unfortunately. Well, like I said, that if you drive up there now, you won't believe the amount of distribution activity, amount of warehouses, including there's a big Amazon and there's a few others up there, a few noteworthy others up there.
You're talking between, there's 6 million people in the Chicago standard statistical area, and there's got to be 3 in Milwaukee. I mean, it's right between the two. It's one hell of a spot.
Well, it's a good, yeah, because what do you want out of distribution? You want, you want to know how much of the population can you reach in 4 hours, how much can you reach in 8 hours, how much can you reach in one day, et cetera. And that's, you know, that's how you, a big factor in your location of distribution centers. That's, you know, that's why Indiana is so good. That's why the area where I live is so good for distribution, is because there's so much access to population in general. It's just a great location for getting things out the door. That the problem that you have in Chicago with distribution is it's just a pain in the ass to get in and out of Chicago. So you get some of the outlier suburbs, but you know, even at that, it can be a real pain. And
two things, and this is a, I'll give my Daily Pullman reference. This stuff was on the drawing board, Kevin. Hell, I was there in the late 70s. They were looking at railroad stuff, obviously, and its distribution. And if you looked at the country corridors and where you could put, you know, high-speed rail, maybe even high-speed freight, and one of them was clearly Milwaukee through Chicago, through your area, through Jackson, Michigan, to Detroit, and to Cleveland. And those were the areas that they were, I don't know what they called them. Another one was take Cleveland through Columbus to Cincinnati. And all the cities, all the serious towns you're going through there, you're going through the state capital. I mean, you almost couldn't lose with that many people needing to get from place to place. And if you could do some kind of a, you know, a package or package cars, a couple of package cars on the back of the passenger car, like people used to do for your real high speed stuff that has to be there the next day, and you can get it there in a couple hours. I mean, this was people were thinking about this stuff almost 55 years ago, Kevin, and now people are going, man, isn't it bizarre that there's a connection between Chicago and Milwaukee? Well, duh, I mean, right? I mean, this. We could have done so much better, both in rail. I mean, can you imagine if at the back of if you ran five passenger trains a day, and they put two cars in the back that you could load with UPS stuff or whatever? I mean, how simple would that be? We don't do anything like that, do we?
Well, yeah, and you know, UPS is a different.
Well, I'm talking about whatever. I'm talking about, you know, quick package delivery overnight. I mean, if you're a law firm, you could put something in the envelope in the Detroit train station at 9 a.m. and it'd be in Chicago by noon.
Oh yeah, and they've done a certain amount of that, and even Amtrak was doing some of that for a while, which is not what I want to see happen. But
I don't know who to run it, but that's what we're talking about, passenger rail with some. But the imagination never seems to make it to fruition. I told you I went to this wake a few weeks ago. Audrey and I went down by. It's in Elburn of Illinois. If you ever want to go somewhere, go to Elburn. But there's a huge, what do you call it, a national cemetery, right, for veterans? And it's kind of, wait, Kevin, it's out in the middle of nowhere, and it's a blustery place. But still, people are very nice out there and the whole bit. And the amount of, I don't know if you've been down there lately, but you just don't hang around in Elburn, but the Joliet area near where the NASCAR track is, they've had a big diversion of rail down there, especially since the Canadian National has bought that big loop track around Chicago. And a lot of your distribution areas, but I don't know when you say a distribution area, Kevin, there's places down there that are trucking docks. And I used to work on one that had 30 doors, which is pretty good size. Kevin, these things must have 100 doors. They're massive places. In that, I went by about 5 of them. Not one of them had a truck there. Are these things, are they white elephants? Were they hoping for something to get on there? Or was it too much in one spot or what?
No, I see them all the time that are full.
I'm saying this particular area, I went by a couple of them. Are they not finished or... They're just not open yet, or was a bad idea, or what are we talking about? It didn't look like there was any construction going on. It looked like they're all done, or there was nobody there. I probably saw 4 or 5 of them like that. Does that just mean that they're waiting for the rail connection, or what? I don't know. That's what I'm asking.
There isn't a lot of distribution that happens directly from rail. There are actually, you know, a few warehouses and factories where actually the rail can pull right up and unload there, but that's rare. That's not typical. Rail is about everything up to the last mile, and then you take the shipping container off of the rail and you take it, you put it on a truck and drive it where it has to go. That's why that is more conducive to things like manufacturing parts and supplies, things that are not so time sensitive. That's why it is conducive to things like large-scale distribution, where you stock a lot of something and you distribute it as, might be, for instance, automotive supplies. You might stock a lot of motor oil and stuff like that, and it gets, you ship it out and deliver it to mechanics and car repair places. Dealers for their service or operations, those kinds of things. But you're not nearly as likely to see somebody going via freight rail to do overnight shipping or anything else. So that's not going to be a FedEx, UPS type of thing for the most part.
Well, they used to, railroads, there used to be an express freight train that left every, 6 o'clock at night from Minneapolis, was here by morning. Now, I don't know if that was containers or whether it was grain shipments or boxcars or what, but I guess what I'm saying is, are all these, when they do this, when people, go to the frontier, is every one of them a good deal, or are there some white elephants out there? I guess there's got to be a couple.
Probably.
What do you make of, again, I'm trying to get out of my guess, what the year is going to bring, and it's kind of a selfish thing, Kevin, because we had such a really good year in the metals this year for people, and we had a lot of people, when I say we have, through discussions with clients, that's why, every client has a different looking portfolio, right? And people say, well, gee, you were so smart in being in the metals last year, and you had this huge return, and I said, well, okay, I was that smart, but I also was a year too early. And oh, by the way, The same people that put money in metals probably had some money in T-bills. And if I was really smart, I wouldn't have had any money in T-bills. It'd have been totally in the metals, right? So there's never anything perfect. But now the coming year, I don't think silver is going to triple or quadruple again. I mean, it might, but I doubt it. And we're kind of looking for what segments are we going to put there. And, you know, you've mentioned, and Carl and a few other people, that there's some wordage coming out of the administration that this year they might try and do something with the healthcare problem and healthcare expense problem. So we had a nice year for people in the XLV, which is the healthcare piece of the S&P. And now, you know, my brother Dan says, I don't know if they're actually true to their word and they start working on some of these cost areas, maybe the XLV is not going to be as good a return as last year. Maybe. I mean, these are the thought process you go through every January, Kevin, when you're trying to set people up. And you know, they have input, too. That's why January is kind of a fun month. You get to talk to people and rethink. But we're hemming and hawing on the oil part here. And so far, we've put some people in the XLE. And for the first 2 weeks, you know, we look like we bought the bottom, but that's 2 weeks. What do you think? What if you could name a sector? I mean, there's like nine little sectors of the S&P. They all got like an X in front of them. I can't name all nine of them, but the XLF is the banking industry. XLV is the healthcare. XLE is oil. And there's a manufacturing, and there's a retail. Is there a spot? The reason why we do this, Kevin, is because generally the option markets are pretty liquid in there. And also, I will be the first to admit that if you wanted to be in oil, I would recommend, from my selfishness, the XLE. Because if I picked one oil company and I picked the wrong one, I'd never forgive myself, basically. I mean, okay, let's be an Exxon, and all of a sudden, you know, Exxon and the White House are fighting and everybody else goes up and Exxon goes down. I mean, that'd be the one I'd pick, right? So I don't really want to do that. So I'd rather it's hard enough to pick an industry, let alone a company, right? Unless you know something about the place. Do you have any view on this? Where do you think, you know, with all the words flying back and forth out of Washington, where would you put it? Which industry do you think is actually going to like benefit coming the next year?
Oh, I think it's all about AI, Tom, and this is just going to be the big booming year of AI. 1001, 1002, 1003. I just said that because Carl's online, and I just wanted to annoy him.
So all in NVIDIA.
Now, what I do think in the technology world, and I think I've shared this before, is that I think it's going to start becoming all about the applications. Because what's AI really as it sits now? As far as I'm concerned, AI means we have a crap ton of processing power available, and you know, it's just a little bit. I don't even want to say a little bit. We've had an explosion in processing capacity over the last few years, the ability to just do more in the same space. That's the constant evolution that has always happened, so that's not news or unusual. And we call it AI, but it's really just doing what you and I could do. There's nothing artificial about it. It's just doing a lot of the stuff that we can do and doing it way faster. And that's fine. There's value to that. But there's only value to it if people are able to take advantage of that power, of that processing power. And I think that's all in the application. So I would be looking at people, you know, the big ERP producers, and some interesting little upstarts as well that are in there. But your biggies are, you know, Oracle NetSuite and SAP and Microsoft Dynamics. You know, those are the ones that are writing a lot of new functionality, and the easiest description of a use case, and it's just one, would be in demand planning. The ability to go out, take advantage of all the, you know, the big data analytics functions that have existed in the world for a while, and to call them down into a demand plan for your company, that isn't just saying, well, we're going to do last year plus 3% or last year plus 5%, but we're really going to have our pulse on, you know, the trends in the market and start adapting accordingly. And I think those kinds of applications are going to be the ones that are successfully using any technology advancement that we've made in the last few years.
I would agree with you 100%, which I'm not supposed to do, but I mean, it is watching the stuff every day, which I do and you don't, fortunately for you, is, what do you say, in the trading floor, this shit is moving, Kevin. I mean, and I mean, look at this Oracle. You just mentioned Oracle, right? So they have been a non-performer since really 2000, really, because I mean, they were one of the original crash people. And the stock this year at one point was 125. And then all of a sudden it starts moving up. They get some deal where, I mean, I don't know what the politics were between them and TikTok and the White House and whatever. All of a sudden the thing is the cat's ass, right? And then it's 325, and you can't wait to stumble into the damn thing. Well, now it's 191. It's $30 less than before any of this stuff started, wherever the stuff even was. I mean, I don't know if it was rumor from the White House. I almost don't care. I mean, I'm like, all I know is someplace, somewhere, this thing, you had to have it, and then 4 days later, you didn't have to have it. Now, nobody wants it. And now, you know, you look at this Micron, thing's up 5.5% today. And you see these things kind of... What I'm doing here, believe it or not, Kevin, is I'm agreeing with you, but it almost seems like it's changing on a daily basis. One day, AMD's to the moon. The next day, oh, no, they're not, to Microsoft. I mean, there seems to be patterns going on within these 15 stocks that I cannot keep track of. And I don't know if anybody is, or if they just start moving, and it's such a momentum trade that Micron's up today, somebody must know something, we better buy Micron, or does somebody actually know something? And it's kind of crazy within this whole community you just described. And yes, below all that, there's some logic to something. The question is where.
Yeah, because I think we get enamored of any technology, any advancement in the technology, which is fine. But then sooner or later, somebody says, "So what? What are you going to do with it?" And that becomes the punchline to it. And really, in Oracle's case, they've always had a really good database product. If you were looking at who the big dogs were in the industry. Just for database systems, it would be Oracle and Microsoft, and then, you know, then you can get into some open source stuff, and but, you know, is it really, you know, is that really a big dog? I would say no. But then you get but the question gets to be that's all built around structured data, you know, where you can build a table and say, this is my customer table, this is my product table, et cetera. It's very, very structured in how it works. So the question is, can you make the advancement into unstructured data? Imagine if you're trying to figure out what's going on with trends, and you're scraping a lot of material off of social media. You and I could be saying the same damn thing, but the way we post it on social media is totally different. How do you go through and make sense out of all that? And that's, you know, that's where the big analytics function is, and that's also where the benefit of all the processing power that we have available to us now is, because it takes a ton of stuff, it takes a lot of cloud space to do it, and if you can do that and make some sense out of it, you have an advantage over competitors.
Well, I just to lab this out there, and again, I'm absolutely agreeing, but the money changing hands, Kevin, I'll let you know how much this is. I don't have the time here to, well, I guess I could, but if you were to say to everybody who has some kind of an eye on the market, you'd say, all right, well, there's the top seven stocks and maybe the top five or six. And, oh, by the way, you probably want to add Micron, you might want to add Oracle, you might want to add AMD and a few others into this cadre of stuff that looks like they're the future kind of this area, all right? And I don't think you'd be wrong by saying that, but the idea, the impression there is they're all going to kind of walk together somehow. Maybe they're going to split off somewhat, but since September, okay, the Oracle, which I would lob in that group, although you and Carl know more about what they do, I know from my CBOE days that they're into huge data storage stuff, more so than they're not the same as NVIDIA, but they're so since the thing shot up in October, say September, I don't have that chart up right now, but from memory here I'm saying it's gone from 325 or so down to 190. Okay, now that's one hell of a move. Now I'm looking at this Micron, and this stock has gone from in my lifetime on the trading floor has gone from like $7 to $100 and back again probably four times. This thing in September is 125. It's now 355. So if you and I would have been clever enough to buy 2,000 shares of Micron in September and sell 2,000 shares of Oracle, we'd be up $400 on the pairs trade. And yet most people like me might like group them in, yeah, they're tech companies. Well, sure as hell, a lot different than where they're going since September. I mean, that's the part that I'm nervous about. When you start putting people's money in there, I don't want to be the guy in the Oracle. I'd rather be the guy in the Micron. But if I was in Micron right now, I think I'd be dumping it because it looks pretty high to me. But I mean, this is crazy world is what I'm trying to say, and it's really hard to keep track. You would think they're all sort of doing the same thing, but they're not somehow.
Everybody's following different tacks. Carl, you can jump into this because you have a lot of good insights into the into where technology is going.
Okay.
Yeah.
did you have that Paris trade on? Were you long Micron short?
No, and I'll tell you that the big problem here. So, all right. What you're seeing, Micron, and by the way, SanDisk, another one, right? Just take a look at that chart.
Yeah.
What's happening here is, and Chief, we've talked about this a couple of times, is that these AI companies have bought forward all of the memory, all the RAM wafer capacity for the next year and a half.
Really? Okay. You have mentioned that.
Right. Now, well, here's the problem. They've bought this forward not just for, sticks of memory that go in PCs or whatever have you, but at the fab level for things that are not yet chips.
What does that mean?
All right. So when you make semiconductors, modern semiconductors, not capacitors or whatever, but, CPUs, memory chips, things like this. They're essentially printed using a lithography process. And there's companies that make that equipment. By the way, it's extremely expensive. It's not the kind of thing that you could turn around and put one.
Who do you buy the equipment from? Who makes it?
There's a handful of companies that's their specialty. Okay, and it's...
Are they here?
Well, kind of, sort of, but not really. All right? I mean, this is... But this is one of those places where you really can't just turn around and say we're gonna make these things tomorrow. So ASML is one of these firms. Okay, and if you take a look at their stock price in the last 6 months or so, they've gone from around $700 to like $1,350.
Well, that's a ways, yeah.
Yeah, it's a double. All right, but and the reason is these are firms that make the equipment. Now the problem for anybody that says, well, we have this boom, I'm going to go get in on this, and I'm going to order up ten of these lithography machines and stick up a building and blah, 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 blah. No, you're not. All right. Because it's going to take you 3 to 5 years to get that thing online. And part of the reason for that is these are clean room kind of environmental devices. You can't just turn one of these things on and say, oh, by the way, now I'm making chips. It doesn't work like that.
Place has to be totally sterile and all that stuff.
You're wearing moon suits when you go in the room when these things are running. All right. It is a no bullshit. I mean, you have to go through decontam and because literally a human hair will screw these things up. All right. So this is a very, very high precision work. But when you get done making these things, what you have is a wafer. It's it it's a thing that has chips on it. There's more than one on there. And then those have to be subdivided. They have to be graded because not all of them will pass test. And then after they're graded and pass test, then they have to be put on a carrier, and that's at the point at which they're soldered onto a, you know, some kind of a carrying thing, okay, a, you know, a memory stick or whatever have you. In the case of a processor, it's a that's the thing that has the metal cap on it that now goes into a PC, all right, or whatever have you. These the further advanced devices in this area that can run at smaller size. Okay, so you're talking about nanometers here of actual element size within the chip. They are very long lead time, very expensive, and they have extreme environmental requirements in the room where they run. So building a
how do you ship the damn things, or do you assemble them on site?
Well, they get assembled. The equipment is, you know, we're not talking about small little stuff here. Okay. These are not, it's not like a little CNC machine that you buy and you put in a machine shop and turn it on and it makes parts. It's not at all like that. So the problem you have here is there's only so much of this capacity. It costs a lot of money to put more of it up, and it takes a lot of time to put more of it up. All right. So you've got very natural constraints in capacity changes. So what these guys have done within the so-called AI field, and I would argue this is yet another example of 15 United States code that's supposed to mean something and all of a sudden doesn't, right? Is that they have turned around and they have between them, not just one company, but between them, have colluded and bought forward all of the RAM capacity. Now, there's a serious problem with this that a lot of people do not appreciate, which is that memory chips are in everything. All right, they're in your phone, they're in your PC, they're in your microwave oven, although you know, not the newer series that are the ones that are the problem here, because of course the ones that are being all bought up are there. Okay, they're the ones that are being bought up in that regard.
Are these, it sounds like you've been to one of these factories, where are they?
Well, most of them are in places like Taiwan.
Okay, that's a problem.
All right, so yeah, so this is not something you can just turn around and say, okay, you know, no big deal. That's not how it works. But of course, this is one of the things that the Trump administration and for that matter Biden before him, one of the things that was a very serious concern is that, well, what happens if China goes in there and invades, right?
Well, yeah, that would be a problem.
Oops, yeah. But the other problem that comes up here, and this is very, you know, very real and has a very bad downstream effect, is that at the same time this has happened, as you probably know, there's been essentially a deprecation of all of the computers out there that run Windows 10. Okay, now Microsoft has essentially deprecated all of those in that they ended support for it. Now that happened fairly recently. There is a big problem here, and that is that many of those machines are missing an essential component that is in the current devices. Okay.
You mean Windows 11 and further?
Windows 11 and further, correct. And essentially what this means is I can't put Windows 11, put it on there because the machine does not meet the requirements.
By the way, I have one sitting right here like that.
This is a very, you know, right.
But I keep it for all my emails because I don't want to touch that.
Well, here's the problem that we get with this, all right? And this is a serious issue, is that if I've got a Windows 10 machine and it's been deprecated like this, and they have been, we've got big trouble, because when Microsoft did this, what that means is no more security updates. That doesn't mean that Windows 10 stops working. It doesn't stop working. What it does mean is no more security updates. Now, if you are a software products manufacturer, let's just take, for example, Quicken, okay? Because you have QuickBooks, you have TurboTax, okay, which is now all of a sudden relevant again, right? Because it's tax season.
Yep.
I use TurboTax, all right? So, I mean, this is all of a sudden. You go on and you get the TurboTax 2025 version, and it says Windows 11 or the whatever the current Mac OS version is. Will not run on 10 at all. That's not because it can't. It's because Intuit has decided they won't allow it because there's the potential for a security problem that they have no control over. I think that's a perfectly defensible business decision.
Oh, I would agree.
On Intuit's part.
We make absolutely sure that the ones that we have that don't do that don't touch anything else.
Well, I'm just saying. I think that's a completely defensible business decision. In no way am I bagging on Intuit here for this. However, there is a problem with this, which is that what happens when I need to buy a new PC as a result of this deprecation and I can't get any memory for it?
Well, there is another problem with it.
Chief, this is not just in... See, people think this is just in the AI space. Okay? No, it's not. It's in all areas of technology-based things. This is why I've said this is something that, in my opinion, is a wildly illegal act, and it's a criminal
act that needs to be stomped on. Before you roll into that, is there a way you and maybe Kevin can give us... I don't know, and I don't think a lot of the listeners know. We always talk about Taiwan, and there's a picture, and obviously, I was telling the history the other day of George Marshall trying to make peace between Mao Zedong and Chiang Kai-shek, and it didn't work out, and Chiang Kai-shek dashed off to Taiwan. But in the current world, how did all that stuff, and it's a big question, move to Taiwan from any other place? And what is the social difference between Taiwan and mainland? It doesn't sound like the people in Taiwan are making all the rice they can eat sewing blue jeans together. It sounds like it's a much more educated, much more highly paid populace. Is it? I mean, I've never been to either place. What sets them so apart?
I haven't been to either one. Okay, but this is the oddity of the entire Chinese governmental CCP. They're communists at their core, right? I mean, that's...
But the same person in Taiwan who's doing all this crap can't be the same guy who's putting blue jeans together by sewing them by hand. I mean,
No, he's not. And this is part of the problem, is that you've had a net migration over time of the people more or less at the top of their game, out of the mainland and into Taiwan, okay? And so this is kind of... Maybe one of the ways to think about this is what the East India Trading Company tried to do, where they had their production in certain places. It wasn't advantageous for them to be doing all of that in Britain.
Yeah.
All right. So, it's just business, right? It's just business. Well, yeah, okay, it's just business, but it's also politics. And oh, by the way, the people in Taiwan have gotten kind of used to the idea of not having to put up with as much of the CCP crap visibly. The problem is that you really do have to put up with it because it is China, whether you like
it
or not.
Oh, yeah.
And we've had this stupid, two-place, one-China policy garbage that's gone on for decades. The geopolitics on this are pretty weird.
Well, blame it on Mao and Chiang Kai-shek. They started it.
Well, yeah, they did, and you know, there it is.
Well, it was like we decided that. We tried to help out, and we didn't want it.
Oh, no, I'm not saying that we're responsible for it. We're not. They're responsible for it. They're the ones that did it.
We sent our best man there, George Marshall, and he couldn't make head or tail of those two idiots.
Well, they've got lots of reasons to, you know, give us the finger, right? I mean, when you get down to it.
Well, he said he never saw two people that were so, could care less about how many people died and everything in those two guys.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's just, Chief, there is a serious divergence between American and, to some extent, Western European ideals when it comes to the value of human life and everybody else on the planet.
Yeah.
And anybody that doesn't recognize that and recognize that this had better be the defining element of policy when it comes to who you let in the country and for what purpose and how will you police it and da-da-da-da-da-da-da and all this, boy, are you stupid. And, you know, people are, oh, that's jingoistic, that's racist. You know, no, it's not. It's fact. And if other nations and other peoples want to change their mind on this, okay, but until they do, all right, you know, I mean, you have to live in the world you're in. You don't have to like it. But this thing that's, if you're asking, you know, well, so back to the question,
yeah.
Okay, which is where do you go with this, right? And the problem right now is that as Hal has said, as I've said, as Kevin has said, as a lot of people have said, Milton Friedman has said, the cure for high prices is high prices, right? When you have this kind of a spike that has been unnaturally generated, it didn't occur due to some natural set of forces, it occurred due to collusion.
And with the money pouring in on top of it, making it worse.
Well, yeah, hello.
Yeah.
And now you've got this rumor floating around that Trump is going to throw somewhere in the neighborhood of $8,000 per person into the economy. Something like $1.2 trillion is the number that I've seen floating around. All right. Now, he can't do that by himself. That would have to, you know, if he's going to issue, you know, tariff refund checks or whatever the hell you want to call them today, that obviously has to come out of Congress, right?
How do you do that with the last month is the biggest deficit they've ever had?
Chief, if they're stupid enough to do this, you're going to see a 9% TNX inside of, you know, this year. I mean, and by the way, if you think the CPI is a lie now, what do you think it's going to be next month? You know,
with the Doral Country Club will be paid off.
Well, you know, there'll be plenty of things that get paid off, but there'll be plenty of things that go up your butt too. So, I mean, I don't see there's people running this trope right now. They're all over the place. It is the latest thing. It's the latest, quote unquote, support under market valuations, and it is the reason that you better get your house now, because by God, it's going to be 50% more expensive in another, you know, whatever.
Well, except
wait a minute, what about affordability?
Kevin, that's exactly. So here's the thing:
if you have the asset that runs up, you can afford anything.
Well, and the way that you sell this to a credulous American public is, look, we just gave you an $8,000 check.
Well,
right?
Do you think
now, Chief, we just had experience with this a few years ago, right?
Yeah, it wasn't that long ago.
No, it wasn't that long ago that we were just, you know, throwing checks at people and saying, oh, this will help because, you know, you're kind of getting screwed because your business was shut down due to the virus and all this. And what happened to the price of beef? Okay. I mean, now, granted, that was not the only thing. But by the way, what happened to the price of insurance? What happened to the price of houses? What happened to the price of everything?
Well, if you would have, again, the basics of this is, and I don't go through it very often, thank God, because it's too boring. If you're going to send out money, if you're going to spend money from the government, you can do it one of three ways. You can tax people for it.
Yep.
You can borrow it. Or you can print it. If you use one or two, I mean, if you wanted to sell bonds to people that have done very well in the last few years, use the proceeds to send a $1,000 check to the people who haven't done very well. You could do that without making it an inflationary event, but that's not what they're going to do.
caution with that, and the reason is that if you take a look at the analysis that's been run by a substantial number of groups, and some of them don't want to publish their results because they didn't like what they said.
But
then you've got others that have published their results because they do like what they said, but they all seem to come to the same conclusion, which is that you could divide this up by immigrants versus not immigrants, or you can just divide this up by quintile of earning power, right? You take it divided up by quintile of earning power, the problem is that they are a net deficit generator, and the people who are obviously at the top are a net revenue generator. If they are paying taxes, they are. Yes. If you look at it from a standpoint of the federal government's overall budgetary, you know, I sit here at my desk, I am a net payer of taxes compared with what I extract from the federal government. Now,
I would not make that call on a lot of people, but
well, I'm just saying that there's plenty of people who are. All right, not everybody is a net drain.
I know
we're
going off topic here, because what I'm saying
No, we're not, because if you start tossing money at people that are a net drain...
I didn't say that I supported that. What I said was, if you went out and borrowed it and then sent out what you... There's problems with that, too, because now you're going to have interest costs. I didn't say I supported that. What I said was it would not be as inflationary as just printing it.
Right, well, actually, it might be more inflationary.
No, it's not, because you're taking money out and putting money out.
Now, wait a minute. Assuming, right? Remember something. There's none of this bullshit about just printing. Right, that is a lie, Chief. And
it's not a lie.
It is a lie, and you know full well how the federal government's financing.
Okay, when the Fed goes out and buys a mortgage, they write a check to somebody, and it clears.
Okay, the Fed trades in things that have the full faith and credit of the federal government.
No, they have the balance sheet was mortgages for a while.
What the Federal Reserve did during 2008, which is where that all came from, was blatantly illegal.
I understand that. But the fact that they happened.
But the fact of the matter is, and then Congress turned around and retroactively made it legal by giving Fannie and Fred paper full faith and credit.
We don't go too far with this, because people know what the hell we're talking about. Someplace, somewhere, the Fed writes a check and it clears. That's new money. It's like you print it.
And what they bought with the thing was something that was issued as a debt by the federal government of the United States. Without the federal government of the United States issuing that debt security, they couldn't do it.
All I'm saying is, if you're going to spend money, you either have to borrow it, tax it, or print it, or make it up. Let's put it that way. Correct?
The Federal Reserve, unlike the ECB, unlike the Japan Central Bank, both of which can transact in anything they want. Okay. The Federal Reserve, by statute, now, people break laws all the time. By statute, the Federal Reserve can only transact in things that have full faith and credit of the United States.
You can say that all you want. In the last 5 years, they bought $3 trillion worth of mortgages, so obviously they've done other stuff.
No, they didn't. In the last 5 years, those $3 trillion worth of mortgages were all backed by the full faith and credit of the United States. Congress did that after the 2008 crash.
Well, okay, but either way, I'm saying if the way Trump is going to do it, if he's just going to send out checks, it's going
to
be very inflationary.
Treasury's going to have to issue in order for that to happen through some, whether it's through Fannie and Freddie or whether it's through Treasury bills. Yes.
So somehow, but I mean, the point is they have no concept of monetary policy other than the fact, actually, you know, I keep talking about this, but the Weimar Republic, you know, the government to this day considers what they did a success. Well, of course, they're not around, but what happened was the Germany owed, this was, talk about a circle bleep. Germany, after Versailles, which pretty much, Is there anything screwed up the rest of the 20th century more than Versailles?
Oh, God, I don't know. I mean, that's, boy, that one's pretty far up the list.
Right? Yeah, it was pretty far up the list. The way it, because I actually was doing some of this, not because I ever thought I'd get the money, but just to see what's going on in the Never Never world. At the end of the war, the Great War, the war that would end all wars, how'd that work
out? Yeah, the war that lasts, the ending that lasted, what, 10 years?
Yeah, the war to end all wars. Germany owed all his reparations to France and Britain, which I thought those guys are just about as equal on who was at fault in World War One. But, you know, I'm not a big expert in World War One. But anyway, they owe France and Britain all his reparations.
Right.
Okay, which they, well, now, of course, the world goes into depression and they can't afford them. Well, then France and Britain, back in those days, we lent them money for World War One before we joined up.
Right.
And they owed us. So
they owed us, right.
So the money went from Germany to France and Britain to us. Meantime, the U.S. of A., are allowing people in this country to buy allegedly gold-backed bearer bonds from Germany.
Right.
And so people here are buying bonds from Germany. So the stuff is going from our citizens to Germany, to France and Britain, to our government.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, Germany says, well, we can't afford this crap.
Right.
So we owe this, I'll keep it simple, we owe France and Germany $1,000 a month. And so somebody gets a bright idea, goes, well, wait a minute. If we print a whole lot more of these $1,000s to where the point where the $1,000 is worth 50 cents or 20 cents or 2 cents, and we walk to France and Britain and we go, here you go, here's your $1,000, and they go, well, it ain't worth shit. Then maybe they'll renegotiate, which they finally did at some point. Now, in the meantime, every German, not every German person, I will lob this one out there. I mean, I know politically it's the Trump grandfather era over in Germany picked up on this.
Yeah.
And if you ended up, if you had a farm and say your mortgage was, you know.
Oh, you did good.
You did, within 6 months, now that the grain has gone up like 10 times, you walk down to the bank and you said, here's my mortgage payment. And the banker goes, well, that's cool, but that ain't worth squat. But guess what? The ranch is now yours, or the farm. And I'll bet some of those people still own those farms from way back then in the families. Anyway, so the German government, even though now everybody in the country who's a regular stiff is broke, if you own something, you're not broke. And oh, by the way, they managed to renegotiate with Britain and France, and they said, we were successful. If you wrote that story in a book, Carl, would anybody buy it?
Well, yeah, I mean, this is, you know, the fictions that run around about things of that sort is just unbelievable. And we've got the same sort of thing going on now, though, in so many ways. Right? I mean, you know, some of the stuff that Trump has spewed off with lately. Okay, he wants to ban the buying of single-family homes by corporate holders. Okay, no, BlackRock, because they're you know, nice guys to take shots at. So how is it that BlackRock is actually in this market in the first place?
Well, I go through a lot of reasons, but I will say one thing. In one area,
let me just ask.
I mean, just because they're in it doesn't mean they're geniuses. One of the listeners sent me a YouTube about this area in Texas all these prices got bid way up, and now they're crashing down. And guess who's getting taken on the chin is BlackRock.
Yeah, guess who's got bent over the table on that one,
yeah.
Right? Well, but here's the thing: what does cheap credit availability generally do?
I was hoping you were going to go there, because, or else I was going to. The question is,
well, of course I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
Right. What it does is it makes all sorts of malinvestment, which doesn't actually have a market return, look good.
What do you suppose there? Now, if you and I went and bought that house, this is what, I mean, I don't expect the listeners to pay attention to me day after day, but how long have I been ranting about the middle class, the lower class, and I don't care if it's Biden, I don't care if it's Trump, I don't care if it's Biden, they all mouth this stuff all day long, and yet not one of them has done a thing for the, you know, Trump lobbed out the part about the credit card interest being 10%.
Right.
I don't think he'll get there, and I don't know if he's smart enough to know that how many people now, if you know, a bunch of my friends wanted to go out and buy a couple of homes and remodel them, that's their line of credit, is a credit card.
I know what will happen if he actually gets that.
Well, I'm saying, okay. I know when the trading floor went under, a couple guys, and they're not bestest of friends, but they're good friends and clients, they went into the home remodeling business. And one of the guys, he should trade for me. The other guy was a broker for Schwab, I think. I mean, I know. And good guys. And so they put their money together, and they bought one house and remodeled it. And, you know, they paid, you know, it wasn't the world's best neighborhood, I guess. They paid $65,000. They put $35,000 into it. The thing appraised out for $150,000 because they did a lot of sweat equity. Right. I say $35,000. I'm not counting their labor. And all of a sudden, they've got it rented for Section 8 for, you know, X number a month. And they've got a nice tenant and all that kind of stuff. Then they do house two. They get up to like house five. So now they've got, you know, $900 million worth of houses that are assets and they're performing. And they go to the bank and said, well, we'd like to, you know, get a loan for the next one based on the five or six or seven we already own. No, you can't do that.
No, you can't do that. Well, you know, Chief, I've told you, you know.
But now BlackRock can is what you're, I think, where you're going.
Well, yeah, but see, here's the thing is what I, you know, it, as I've pointed out many times on the show, okay, from my own personal experience being the CEO of a modest-sized company, all right, I mean, you know, we had 36 employees. That's, you know, that makes you a modest-sized company, right?
Yep.
They were, the bank that I had done business with almost literally since the place was run out of my closet, all right? I mean, no joke, out of my closet is where it started. Those guys were always looking to pitch us on a revolver as an operating line. Okay?
But it wasn't 25 back then.
Well, now, wait a minute.
Yeah.
But even though, once the company's been established for a while, all right, it's got, you know, a couple million dollars worth of equipment sitting in the, you know, sitting in the computer room.
Right? And you've never missed a payment.
Well, I never made a payment.
Oh, okay, but I'm
all
saying
all the cash, all the percentage of the ownership equity from the corporate balance sheet of all this equipment and everything that we had was 100%. It had no encumbrance against it at all. All right, and yet these guys, no personal guarantee, no loan.
Yeah,
well, you could bite me. Well, that's
you're
C corporation.
You're lucky they didn't make you sign over the deed to your house.
Well, that's exactly what they wanted me to sign over.
Yeah.
All right? And I told them to stick it in the back door.
Was this before, what's the bill? The two knuckleheads. The bill that governs all the... Dodd-Frank, yeah. Was this before
Dodd-Frank? Well, of course. This was the 1990s.
All right. Dodd-Frank made it worse.
Well, yeah, but I'm saying, you know, all these people are like, oh, well, you know, this, that. I'm like, look. As somebody who built a small business and had, you know, every banker from the relatively modest size bank that I actually did business with, we had American National that was after us for a long time.
Yeah.
They ended up, well, they, you know, they're gone now, right? But they were one of the consulting entities on the transaction that ultimately led to, you know, the sale of the firm.
Well, Kevin, you're still here. You have opined on many occasions. I think here in Illinois, you can still get some of that with some of these smaller banks. And you're saying, where does a typical
Chief? Let me tell you what the truth is on this, at least from the 1990s, okay, and the late 80s, because I've seen this on both sides. One of the reasons that I refused to have anything to do with these guys, even though they came banging on me, was that a few years prior to that, when MCS used to do PC installations and stuff like this, I had a customer that had a small manufacturing outfit in the western suburbs. Profitable place, nice guy, had a couple of patents. Okay, so I mean, he's got a lock on a couple of areas of the market for the next, you know, 15 years until the patent runs out, right?
And
until somebody challenges him.
Well, but I mean, he actually did invent the thing. Okay, so I mean, what they were selling, it was an ophthalmological instrument. All right, and we sold them computers. We provided support when they had a problem with the machine or their small network in their building. And that was what we did at the time. Okay, so you get a slight slowdown in the economy. Now, this guy has never had a problem with the revolver in the operating line. The bank called it. He had no way to replace it. He was out of business in 48 hours.
That's unreal. By the way, your girlfriend somehow made it out of the institution you put her in. Kathy Wood is trumping crypto today.
Oh, my God.
I thought she was long gone.
My girlfriend. Thanks a lot, Chief. I love you, dude. But
at least I didn't say Elaine Gazzarelli was your girlfriend.
Well, there you go.
Hey, let me try and refocus you guys a little bit.
Please. Also, let us know. You say the banks do work in your area.
I think so. Yeah. We have some of substance. They're not huge, but. We do have locally owned multi-billion dollar in assets banks in places like First Source, Centier, et cetera, that are really solid banks and good business lenders. But let's go back to where
you want you want the job of refocusing us.
Yes, I do. Because we started down a path of saying where. What should we be looking at for 2026?
Right.
And, Carl came in with a really strong point, and it's a big factor because we can talk about where technology is going, but when you have a handful of companies cornering the market on one means of producing product, I think that has a profound effect on what we should expect to see this year.
Well, it's also very dangerous. And the thing is that, Chief, this is one place where you guys have an edge over the common jack, right? In that the common jack is going to look at this stuff and say, the chart is going from the lower left to the upper right, I'm buying it, right?
Yeah,
you're probably smart enough to say, yeah, but I'm going to box that with some puts or, some kind of a spread because, oh, by the way, when you have people trying to corner a market like this, you remember what happened to the Hunt brothers, right?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And this kind of...
Was it Bunker? What was the other guy's name? Bunker and...
These kinds of things invariably blow up. The problem is when, and of course the challenge is you're looking at this kind of a move saying, I got to get in on this for 2026 because this is where it's going. We know these guys have bought forward all the memory products for the next year. Therefore, I ought to be safe being in that space. That is not necessarily true. You're assuming this thing doesn't blow up in their face sometime during this year, and I think there's a very real possibility it will. So
Plus, it seems to me in the last few days, you could easily have the wrong stock in the space.
Well, that's right. And then there's another wild card coming in this, which is a company that most people have never heard of called SK Hynix. Okay. Now, I happen to have some of their memory. They've actually been in the memory space for a long time, but they're mostly known among the higher end stuff that goes into servers. Okay. So, like, you would not buy their memory chips to go in your desktop computer.
Okay.
But I have them in the server that I have in my basement because I need stuff that has.
How'd you even find out about them? Just because the industry that well?
Well, I know the industry quite well, but they're also for server boards that use error-correcting memory. So your common desktop memory does not correct errors, okay? Cosmic rays are real. They will hit a memory cell and change one of the bits in there. In a desktop machine, when that happens, the machine usually crashes for no apparent reason. There's nothing wrong with it. It just blows up and restarts and, whatever. The problem with servers is that most of the time, a server does a lot of optimization for disk I/O. It's holding a lot of that data in memory for a short period of time before it gets written to disk. And if that gets corrupted and it's not detected, you've destroyed the data on your drive. That is not an acceptable risk for a server. Okay.
Right.
So, as a result, you buy
both a motherboard, a processor, and memory that can handle error correction. So a single bit error gets corrected, a double bit one is detectable but not corrected, but that will tell the system to crash without damaging the data that's on the disks. Okay, so this is a very important thing for servers. But SK Hynix is one of the companies that's a, they are probably the biggest player in that space. They are probably, there's already rumbles out there that they're going public this year. When they do, exactly what kind of dislocation effect and in which direction on price this does to companies like Micron, I don't know. But it's absolutely a risk either way. One, you know,
well, Micron's gone from $100 to $350 in the last 6 months.
Yeah, and the problem here is that, you know, SK could come out, get one of those late 1990s first day trade deals, right, where it triples from wherever the IPO issues, and then everybody could pile out of, you know, the Microns and the other guys in it, and SanDisks, and into them. Or the other way around is it could mark a top. I mean, but they are very likely, simply because of this cornering of the market and therefore what it has done for their internal projections in terms of sales and, you know, and pricing. Unless they get the timing wrong on it, the crash happens as, you know, as they're filing the, you know, the red herring. My guess is that this company do go public this year.
Well,
and I don't know what it's going to do, but, you know, obviously, if you're a regular investor, you can't get involved in it before that happens. But once it does, now you're going to have that as a, you know, as something that is a player in the on the chessboard, so to speak.
I got a quick Micron story. It'll take me 2 seconds. Well, 2 minutes. We this is back when people were trying to learn a lot about options. Now everybody just wants the market to go up. This is probably early 2000. So these guys have a seminar in the Bahamas. And I want to know part of the Bahamas. I get talked into going down there. So down we go, and Audrey's telling me how, God, you're going to love this conch stuff. Well, I had conch for breakfast, lunch. I had enough of conch. I was ready to come home. But anyway, so I'm giving this lecture, and Micron at the time was trading about 95. And this is right before the crash. And so I go, guys, you know, this market has come up. There's 50, 60 people there. I said, at some point, the stock has come up from 10, 20, like pretty rapidly. I mean, is there a number where you're going to roll over on a Monday morning and say, kind of enough, I'm going to lighten up here? Oh, no, it's going straight up. I said, well, how about this? It's trading 95. I'll give you 110 right now. and this guy raises his hand. That just shows how big a crooks you traders really are, because you know, you know it's worth 150. Like, 4 months later, it was 650, plain, yeah. 650. I mean, you can get. I mean, if you were lucky enough to have this Micron here at 100 and it's 350, good God, don't you at least do something to it?
So, well, I mean, if you're not at least protecting that. I mean, I know it's expensive, okay, at the present time to do it, but. If you're not, my opinion is you're out of your mind.
Yeah.
All right. And the same thing with, you know, with any of these other, you know, any of these other names that have seen this kind of a move. I think this is extremely serious and very dangerous.
Is there I was talking to Kevin earlier, you probably were listening, that we like, because I'm not an individual stock picker. I mean, it was never my skill set. Well, we have all kinds of stocks that people bring in, and we manage them for them. But is there one of the indexes in the S&P, you know, the oil? Is there a high tech index in the X's that you like? Is there someplace?
No, here's the basic problem. All right, so all of this is being driven by this AI trade.
Right.
I mean, all of these distortions that are in there, whether it's in memory, whether it's in storage, whether it's all of it's being driven there. Right. The problem is, all right, so I'll give you an example. My opinion, I put an article up on this yesterday, and I talked about it on Tuesday a little bit, and we never really got into the details of it. My opinion, all of these large language model-based AIs, which, and I'll qualify this because it is absolutely a qualified opinion. It has a qualification on it, and people who don't take the qualification are going to be wrong. That is, any so-called artificial intelligence driven system that operates on an unbounded basis. Well, let me define that. A bounded basis is I have my customer database and the invoices, in other words, what they've bought. So I'm, let's say I'm Amazon. And I point a weighted model at those databases and I say, and I tell it to predict what this customer may want to buy.
Okay.
Okay. Now that's a, now that is a weighted prediction. It's not a fact because you don't know in advance, right? But this is where this kind of analysis probably has some value, because if you can, through pattern analysis, make a prediction that actually matches with something I would like to purchase but I don't know about.
This is what people always are trying to do when you buy something anywhere. They say, well, you should look at this too, type of thing.
Right, exactly. Yeah, yeah. And basically, now, I will say this. What Amazon has done with this so far has been stupid, in that every recommendation that it has surfaced to me is either something that is a one-off purchase, and if you had a brain in your head, you'd know it was, that the odds of me wanting another one is zero, or close enough, statistically close enough to zero that there's no point in promoting it to me. Or it's something that I have bought in the past on a serial sequential basis, say for example a vitamin D supplement.
Okay.
And you can say, okay, in 6 months this guy's going to be out of it, right? Assuming he's using it, and so in five I'll suggest that he buy it again. Now that makes that kind of analysis makes some sense.
Yep.
Right. Okay. That's a bounded data set, but all your large language models are not running on that. They're being trained on everything on the internet or whatever have you. The problem is that there was a guy on X that was talking about Elon's large language model, and he has put up this Wikipedia competitor that basically uses his model to generate the pages. And this guy asked it about himself. It claimed he'd been married. Now, he'd never been married.
Well, you wouldn't want to be accused of that if you weren't.
Well, now hold. here's the problem with this. He challenged it, and it turned around and did a deep dive into everything it could reasonably consume about his life that it could find, and turned around and said, "Oh yeah, I was wrong. You weren't." Okay. Now he lauded this as being great. Wrong. That's dead wrong. If you, in a business, or in a medical context, or in an engineering context, or anywhere else, if you are the factual repository about a particular thing, and certainly when it comes to your life, you would be it, right?
Yeah, you would think.
You know what happened. If
you might wonder, we might wonder why it happened, but
well, but you know what happened, yeah. Right? All right, if you rely on one of these large language models and it is consistently full of crap about material facts, you're not the person who knows everything if you're doing the relying. Well, you don't need to ask the AI if you know the facts, right?
Well, I need to do this fact. We got to go on a break.
All right.
S&P futures up 8, NASDAQ futures up 110. We were up a bunch yesterday and kind of, we still ended up on the day yesterday. We kind of closed slinking down. Let's see what that happens today, but we'll be right back. Stacks and Jacks.
Interested in promoting your business to a high-end audience comprised of entrepreneurs, traders, executives, and the everyday business person? Consider advertising on Stocks and Jocks. With a devout listenership covering the Chicago market, along with a vast online presence, advertising on Stocks and Jocks may be just what it takes to put your business over the top. For more information, contact me, Matt Weber, at matt@stocksandjocks.net. That's matt@stocksandjocks.net.
Stocks, Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
Stocks and Jocks.
You are out of control.
Right here, right now, right here, right now.
Lower North Bay, Stocks and Jocks. I'm Tamar Ricky on the board. SP Futures up 8. NASDAQ Futures up 108. Ricky, it looks like we made it down there just before it started to snow, eh? I'm so sure that's all cool. We don't need any snow. No stinking snow for the weekend.
Looking pretty bad out.
Dow futures up 13. Individual stocks in the Dow. I've got Caterpillar up 6. Caterpillar up and down every day. It's becoming a really high vol stock, which is Boy, it sure as hell didn't used to be. It's IBM up 381, Honeywell up 398. Over in Europe, we've got the DAX down 63.2%, FTSE down 8%, call that flat. Techron down 60.7%. Asia, Nikkei down 174, Hang Seng down 78, so not much going on there. Very, very slightly to the downside. Shanghai down 10, so actually pretty slow around the world today. 10-year up 3 basis points, 4.19. This thing is creeping. Carl mentioned that earlier. And by the way, I've got the 30-year is now 4.8. The 30 and the 10 were almost the same for a long period of time, and now they're not. They're like 0.6, 0.7% difference. So that's been widening out here. I don't know how many people do the 30 anymore, but it's kind of significant, although I don't know what it means necessarily. Oil up 62 cents, 59.81, so a little higher than it has been, but still not crazy. Brent up 71 cents, 64.47. RBOB unchanged at 178. Gold down 36 today, but 45.87. Still hanging around his 4,600 number. Silver down 480, 87.54. Was up over 90. It was down a bunch yesterday and it came back on the close, so maybe it'll do that again today. We'll see. But silver's been very volatile. Foreign exchange, dollar still is, 3 weeks in a row, the dollar's been a little strong. The euro's down to 116. It was over 117. British pound, 134, almost flat. It was over 135. Crypto, with Kathy Wood up pushing for it. 95,309, that's up 46 cents, 46 bucks. Reef Force Traffic Weather Sports.
Hey, good morning, Chief. It's currently 7:40 a.m. here in Chicago. We're looking at about, 27 degrees right now with a high of 36. Breezy with a snow shower this morning, which has already started. It's going to be about 1 to 3 inches. Time will be partly to mostly cloudy with a low of 17 degrees. Phoenix, Arizona, 49 degrees right now with a high of 78. Very warm with plenty of sunshine. And tonight will be clear with a low of 47 degrees. Traffic, so the snow has started. So let me make it easier for everybody. No reported accidents yet, but pretty much heavy traffic any road that's inbound into the city. So be patient and drive safe. Lastly, sports. This Sunday, the Bears host the Rams at 5:30 p.m. for the NFC Divisional Playoffs. Yesterday, the Blackhawks lose to Flames 3-1. We also have a loss from the Suns. Suns lose to Pistons 105-108. And finally, today, we got Bulls at Nets at 6:30 p.m. Back over to you guys.
Carl, just a couple of questions here. Sure. By the way, this Excel, what I was talking about, the Spider Select part that adds up to the S&P, that is the technology piece, is the XLK. And their biggest holdings are, as you might expect, NVIDIA, Apple, Microsoft, Broadcom, Palantir, Micron, Advanced Micro, Oracle, Cisco, and then IBM. So those are the top ones. But you ever heard this firm? First of all, I'm so disappointed that none of supporters, shall we say, of the current administration. You ever heard of an outfit called World Liberty Financial?
You sent me something on this, yeah, didn't you?
Yeah.
Yeah, you know, I did a little digging. I was on my way home from skiing in the frozen wasteland up north,
How was that, by the way?
Well, I had one absolutely fabulous day, and one where the snow was a little sticky because it actually rained a little bit.
Well.
Not a lot, but a little bit. And then the third one was, as a result of the place that I was at grooming way too early, the corduroy froze. So where there was snow on top of that, it was good. Where it wasn't, it was horrid. And about 1 p.m, I said, I'm going to the bar.
that'll work.
Well, you know, I mean, there's a certain point at which you say, discretion's a better part of valor. I'm not 18 anymore. If I yard sale this thing, on that stuff, it's going to hurt. So no thanks. But the interesting thing about this is all of these, as I sent back to you this thing that, was claimed happened to a guy in these so-called stable coins.
Yep.
All right. It's just another example of the screwing that people have repeatedly taken in the so-called exchanges for crypto-based things, because unlike, you think of exchange, when someone says the word exchange to me, I think of the same thing probably that
you think of when someone says the word exchange.
Yeah, I don't know. These guys have kind of bastardized that definition a little bit.
Well, yeah, I mean, the premise behind it is that the exchange both blinds the other side of the transaction from you. You have no idea who it was you were transacting with. But the other thing is, they're the ones responsible for making sure it's good.
Which is different, I think, than that exchange where you could bet on the Venezuelan invasion. I think
more than a little, yeah. Right? And oh, by the way, there's a rules-based system that basically means you are not going to get rooked. And the way you align the incentives to make that happen is that the exchange is relatively thinly capitalized. Therefore, it has an extremely strong incentive to make sure margins policed.
Right. Unless they have the ability to tax their members for an oopsie like Options Clearing Corp does.
Right. So if there is a screw-up, there's going to be an awful lot of really angry people, but the person who gets hosed doesn't get hosed, right? In that the hosing gets distributed. But that is, boy, is there a lot of feedback mechanisms available there to prevent that from getting out of control. In the crypto world, none of that exists. And so my challenge from a standpoint of anything in that space is that I can have something that supposedly is worth blah, and then I go try to turn it into something I can spend.
Well, these guys are running around the world essentially selling the stable coin, right?
Well, what just happened, the thing I sent you was a transaction in stable coins.
Well, this is the team of this company.
I get this.
Well, it's Donald Trump, co-founder emeritus,
yeah.
Eric Trump, co-founder, Donald Trump Jr., co-founder,
yeah.
Barron Trump, co-founder, and I guess the brains behind the whole thing, according to our guys Wayne and Andrew, is this guy Stephen Witkoff.
Yeah, I know the name.
But now he's got three of his kids are on the board, and then there's this one guy, Chase Harrow. He's a co-founder. He's taking his board picture, a T-shirt, and a baseball hat turned the wrong way. I mean, first of all, I'm very disappointed that none of the big supporters that are on the show are not on this board.
I wonder why that is. You know, I, and by the way, I'm not a big supporter, so I hope you're not including me in that list.
We all know who they are. All of a sudden, I just seen a picture out here of one of my co-hosts. I go, ah!
You know, it's just the big thing is that, you know, when I look at stuff like this, it's like, you know, the inside baseball crap, right? I mean, you know, yeah. I made a big deal about the thing with the DJT and this fusion company. You know, basically, how do we take a company public without actually having to go through the whole process, right, where people can see under the kimono? Well, that would be the way, right?
Yeah.
You do this, you know, the whole SPAC thing, and then you start rolling things up into there. And all of which, by the way, as far as I'm concerned, is a scam, and everybody involved in it ought to be in jail. But, you know, we don't do that these days. Nobody goes to jail. But, you know, the idea that you actually manage to get, without an enforcement action, of course, go figure, yep. Right? Devin Nunes is you know, running it, and the place is called Donald Trump Media. You have a company that gets rolled up into this that claims this year they're building a commercial power production facility using this fusion technology. Okay, commercial power.
Yep.
All right, here's the problem. They've yet to demonstrate that they can even break even.
Well, you know, the
Now here's the thing, Chief. What you have to realize about that is break even doesn't do anything for you. If you look at a traditional nuclear power plant, they produce three times the thermal energy and what comes out the back end of it as electricity. Now that's because of the technology that we currently use for civilian power. But even if you can better that and only lose a third, right? To be commercially viable, you need to be able to produce 10 times the amount of energy.
All right, we're not going into chemistry or physics here where Carl is heading. What he's saying is, if you have a stick of dynamite and it costs you, you know, X number of energy to blow the thing up, and then when it blows up, it gives you the same amount of energy. You don't get anywhere.
You made nothing.
You made nothing, yeah.
Right, well, and actually you lost.
Yeah, because of all the pain in the ass it did.
Well, not only that, but all conversion involves loss.
But I've explained and maybe ragged a few times about how in Illinois there's only a few like really full-time jobs, like aldermen's or full-time jobs, and actually most states, your representatives and senators, it's considered a part-time job, which means the person can be an attorney and represent people against the state or the city or whatever.
Yeah, isn't that nice?
And but now your governor and your mayor, and probably your your treasurer and so forth, those are full-time jobs. Is it? If one of us got hold of this country at one time, which I don't think anybody went, do we actually have to pass a law that says the friggin' president presidency is a full-time job? This is insane.
What I don't understand about this across the board, okay, and this goes for Congress too, and it goes for all the other
Congress things. Used to be a full-time job. You weren't supposed to trade or anything.
Well, point being, there is actually a law on this. It's the Honest Services Law. Okay? It is actually a crime, not a civil infraction. It is a crime to violate that. And this has been used against state officials and things like this. But the Honest Services Law basically is that you are a public servant. Your service is supposed to be honest.
Well, yeah.
Okay. Go figure.
Well,
right?
That's different as to whether it's full time or not.
No, inside baseball violates that.
Well, I can quote him because I remember the day.
Now, Chief, tell me what possible thing that bears on anything in the United States isn't in some way touched in some form or fashion by the presidency.
Well, it is. For sure it is.
Well, of course it is.
And more so kind of as we weave business involved. I mean, there always was government influence in the business, certainly in wartime and things like that. But
yeah,
you really didn't. There was a time, and boy, I remember it, where if all of a sudden, we had a client. I hope the guy's still alive. He was a guy that would he was a very good. I don't know, must have been an electrical engineer of some kind. But he would if somebody was going to do, say, a huge addition in McCormick Place or something, the electrical geniuses would write up all the electrical plans and all this stuff, and they'd say, this 5-inch pipe here, 4-inch pipe there,
right,
and all this crap. Well, this guy's, he was like a manufacturing engineer. He would go through all the drawings, and when people would say, you need this many fasteners, this kind of fasteners, he would say, no, they don't. They need like 4 times more of this one and 3 times more of that one. So when the work started, he would pull in with his, pretty big box truck.
Right.
And he'd say, guys, here's the drawings. Looks to me, by the way, aren't you out of these fasteners? The guy goes, yeah, like we're already out of them. and he goes, just so happens I'm in the fastener business, and he didn't screw anybody on prices. And by the way, they're all in the truck.
Here we are.
And he goes, I'm not going to charge any more to anybody else, but they're here right now. But, I could see stuff like that. There was room in all this stuff for entrepreneurs. You didn't have to tell the Pullman with the rail car contract from Boston or Amtrak. Somebody would knock on the door and say, hey, you're building this piece of the siding of it. I don't even know if you have a machine that's up and running, but we do. How about we make that piece for you? So there was all this stuff happening that made an economy work. And when I see some of this stuff happening now, I don't know that it does to that extent anymore, and I think it's a problem.
I think the most serious issue of this is, and all I got to do is look at the people that go into Congress, that are modest, of modest means, shall we say? Okay.
And most of them are probably, especially some of the smaller states and so forth.
Well, maybe all right. So I would argue that people that get a Senate seat tend to be a little further up the line.
Oh, God, yeah.
I mean, you know, they're both smarter and they've gone further in their life already, right, by the time they get to be a senator.
Well, right, by definition, you're 5 years older.
Well, means usually
probably 15 years older.
But you know, I mean, this has been my observation dealing with both sides of this, okay, in a political context for a substantial period of time, is that you can claim that there's an awful lot of dim bulbs in the House. And you're right, there are. However, not so much when it comes to the Senate.
No.
All right. But here's the thing that I just do not accept, and yet we do in this country. We put up with it. You have somebody who is literally a Starbucks barista who gets a House seat. Okay, fine. That, you know, no problem there.
There's 435 of them, so that's okay.
I understand that. Okay, but that's okay, because you know what? New blood and new ideas are not, that's not a bad thing, right? I mean, that in general, that's a good thing. The problem is, 5 years later, this person has $5 million.
Well, that's an issue.
How?
Well, I mean, when you, let's back up on the first one a little bit. I knew this lady in Ogden Dunes. You know, I'm still 6'2", she's 5'0" on a good day, so the two of us are kind of talking. Well, finally one night we're at this place and the music's too loud, so I'm going out on the balcony, and who's sitting out there but her. I sit down and we ended up having like an hour conversation, and I don't know that she was a genius of any sort. She just retired from, I think, I don't know if she's in the Senate or the rep for the state of Indiana. Everybody liked her. I mean, she'd come to every cookout. You know, we're not talking about guards or nothing like that. And she was sitting down. I said, "Well, tell me how, you know, what were your biggest challenges?" And she said, "Well, you know, I served like, I don't know how many terms," which of course people would say, "Oh God, she was there too long." She goes, "Well, the first three or four terms, they put me in, I was on whatever, the highway something something committee."
Right.
And she said, "You know, it took me," she goes, "I'm not the brightest bulb, but I'm not a dummy either." She goes, "It took me a real long time, like, you know, months, maybe even a year, to go through all these different contracts for this road, this bridge, this stuff, and see what people were writing up, see how these things were writing, I mean, how we could do them better." She goes, "It took me a long time to really be an expert on this stuff, to where when these guys came in, I knew as much as they did."
Right.
And I started to make some pretty serious progress. And then they asked me, since I, you know, it showed some acumen, so she used the term willingness to learn, they put me on a different committee, the medical committee. She goes, "That was another brand of ball, to know who's paying who."
Oh, yeah.
She goes, "That was probably twice the homework." So I don't know if she was the genius in the first place, but she was willing to sit down and put her nose to the grindstone. If you, me being on the board of the SIBO, which is a small thing, being a committee chair was a shit ton of work to do it right.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if somebody sits on one of these committees, it was like McCain when Teddy Kennedy died.
Yeah.
He said, you know, he goes, "I don't know if we ever agreed on politics ever." He says, "But the fact is, the guy was the best committee chairman that ever was in this place. He had the best people working for him. If you were on the committee, if you were diametrically opposed, he would hear you out. If he had any possibility, he could put what you wanted, some shred of what you wanted in the bill, because he didn't think you were an idiot, he would do it, and then you'd go out and have a beer afterward." he goes, "You don't see anything like that today."
Right. The thing is that it's when I moved to Florida, okay, so, you know, this was right, you know, before 9/11, it was around that time, all right? So as soon as I get there, this was when Scarborough won the election for the seat and then turns around and signs a deal to be do the Morning Joe thing. Okay, so he resigns and forces the state to eat the cost of a special election to fill his seat. Now, that was extremely rude, because he had to have been negotiating that deal before he actually ran. Okay.
So this is a House seat, so you can't appoint somebody, okay.
Right, it's a House seat, so there has to be a special election. All right, so the Republican Party, as it turns out, one of the local chairs of one of the local groups happens to live across the street, and they have a daughter who's my daughter's age at the time, and they start playing, and so, you know, we start talking and things like this. Well, he immediately picks up on, hey, you know, this guy's a former CEO, technology guy, and, you know, da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Hey, why don't you run for that open seat? And, you know, and he and I talked enough that he knew that I was more or less compatible with the GOP as opposed to the Democrats, right? And I said, you know, I said, I said, this is what I want you to take back to the committee in the, you know, in the district. I said, you tell them, I'd be more than happy to run for the seat, but you're funding it. Not $1 of my money is going to get spent on the campaign. Oh, no, 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 no. We, you know, that's not how this works. There's probably 8-10 people that want to run. I said, and the only reason that those 8 or 10 people want to run for the seat is because then they're going to use it to fatten their portfolio, because they just went out and blew $100,000, $50,000, $200,000.
Well, yeah, grand. I took two classes, and I'm proud to say this, from Nobel Prize winning George Stigler. Fascinating guy. I actually enjoyed his classes more than I did Milton Friedman's, because I'm more of a, you know, it's kind of my shtick. But somebody asked him one day, they go, how do you stop Chicago corruption? He goes, now, there's an interesting question.
Yeah.
He goes, I can stop it tomorrow. The guy goes, sure. How the hell are you going to do that? He says, well, you have this kind of, what was the word he used? This, not bizarre, but he goes, well, something like conflicted, and I forget the word. You have this conflicted view of government. You have people that are aldermen that are a part-time job. He goes,
right.
You're paying them $10,000 a year, which you know is not enough.
That's not enough.
You
right.
say you're paying them because you know they're cheating, or they're going to have
right.
to cheat. And then when they cheat, you're pissed off. He goes, the whole thing is kind of a mess. He goes, what? And at the time, he goes, the mayor, Richard J. Daley, was the mayor, and he says the mayor makes, you know, $40,000 a year or something. He goes, the head of General Motors is making, you know, $300,000 a year.
Yeah.
And he goes,
so why do I want to be mayor
and
unless
he says,
I'm
well,
screwing people?
Yeah, he says, well, right. But now the mayor is a full-time job, by the way.
Right.
And so he says, well, now, he goes, and my budget is probably bigger, and I've got more employees.
Right.
He goes, so if you wanted to do this right, I would give the mayor $1.5 million a year.
Right.
And he goes, but by the way, you're
nothing
only,
else.
You're only getting 100. The rest is
right.
going into escrow. And every year that you're not convicted of anything or be caught on the naughty list, we're going to free up a couple $100,000 and give it to you. We're not going
right.
to give it to you all at once. He goes, I could clean that up tomorrow. He goes, one alderman, boy, is this true today? One alderman can direct millions of dollars worth of business to somebody, and you expect him to not take anything. He goes, that's not the way people work.
Right.
You go, so, I mean, you can't have somebody sitting in the House of Representatives with two houses, unless you want to be like Paul Ryan and sleep in your office. I mean, you need two places to live. You got to go back and forth to your family.
Well, Chief, what it basically comes down to is you have to get rid of the, you have to make the incentives match up with what you're asking people to do.
But it's also, it's almost like, how can I say this, Greg? It's like an inflationary part. I make a dash here pretty somebody. I make jokes all the fact that, you know, I manage people's monies all day, and some of my accounts are pretty big. And, you know, we're talking 7-8 figures.
Right.
If somebody dropped $1 trillion on me, I really wouldn't. I don't even, what does $1 trillion even mean? I mean, I don't even know. So, I mean, when you talk about, you know, every man, if you walk into, you know, to bars and restaurants and coffee shops and say, everybody's going to say, man, I can't believe how screwed up it is that it's going to cost, you know, $20 million bucks for this Senate election if it's contested. And I'll be the ass as usual, and I'd say, guys, there's got to be 200 companies in this country and 100 swinging idiots that would be happy to fund that guy's entire campaign, because that's how much money that they are parceling out to people. They look at me like they got four heads. They have no idea how much money is involved and how much that is coming out of the government coffers. To everybody, not, you know, to the military, to, you know, the contractors on Trump's golf course, wherever it is. I mean, the Hunter, you know, it's going to Ukraine that Hunter Biden's chasing. I mean, the amount of money flying out of the place is incredible. You compare that to a $10 million campaign, it's like somebody just peed in your driveway, right? It's not even close.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how you, in this inflationary world, how do you get people, I'll say, like me and the rest of us, to even understand how much money's out there for this crap?
The easiest way to think about it is simply how many people go into Congress with that are middle class Joes, maybe a little better. Maybe they got $1 million, and 5 years later they got 10.
Well, is
okay. And by the way, the salary, there is no possible way that came from them saving their salary.
Let's tee that. We've had three or four guests now in the last 2 weeks. We come to the same conclusion. Where are they getting it? I mean, you can't really. When I was on the SIBO, and somebody, we had Tom Foley, we had big shots, we had Phil Graham. The most we could give them was $500.
Chief, why do you think that Congress refuses to enforce the insider trading laws against their own people? And they won't pass a law that says it's illegal.
But what I'm trying to get at here. Let's talk about it Tuesday. The trading part, you know, I get. I mean, that's me. Okay,
well, hello.
You know, but I'm saying not everyone is making $7 million, and you really can't go out as a senator and get a $100,000 speaking engagement like Janet Yellen could do after she was out. I guess my question to you is, where the hell are they getting it if they're not trading it?
Well, they are trading.
I don't think they all are. I don't think they even have to know what they're doing on it.
Well, no, a lot of them.
Well, first question, we got to go. But first question is, right. Is it their personal wealth, or are they coming out of there with a $7 million pack?
No, it's also the family. It's also family connections. You'd steer business to people, to your
but they
kid.
Can't give it to you. They've got to give it to your pack or something, right?
No. You can have something as long as it's not. They can't give it to your campaign, but you can have a business on the side.
Well, that's again my point. Are these full-time jobs? Or they used to be. Let's talk about it on Tuesday. All I know is that we wrote Tom Foley a $500 check, and I don't think we bought Tom Foley for $500. Do you?
Neither do I.
No, I mean. So I'm just saying, yeah. Or Phil Graham. I mean, you know, whatever. He was so funny. My buddy Dr. J. Whenever we went to New York, we'd always go to. He always liked going to Canal Street and buying all these ties, right?
Yeah.
So he's got this incredibly loud yellow tie he wears. And Phil Graham's a big dude. He's as big as me. And he walks up with his coffee and he goes, "Hey, Sonic, look at that tie. If I wasn't awake already, that would really have woken me up." Some of these guys are characters.
Yeah, well, there you go.
But his wife was the one who was on Accents board, remember? Wendy? I think a lot of it's coming through the wife.
That is where the mass corruption comes from.
Well, that's what did what's his name? The guy who was the he was the old speaker, McConnell.
McConnell.
Yeah, his wife. He's got the Asian wife who was on how many boards?
Which one? Which board are we talking about?
Right. S&P futures up 10. Nasdaq futures up 133. You like the Bears tomorrow? I think the Rams got a little better team, but I don't know. We'll see. The Bears have been able to do all right so far.
Yeah, we'll see how that all plays out. I don't know that I care so much about the National Felons League, so there you go.
I know. I don't. Plus, I really don't want to have to give them a stadium if they win either. So, Ricky, nice job. Oh, by the way, no Stacks and Jacks on Monday. We're off because MLK Day. No markets, no banks.
Yeah.
So, we'll the next person we'll talk to is Carl Tuesday morning.
Be me in the morning. Yes.
There you go. Right. Have a good weekend, everybody.
That's all, folks.